Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, March 12, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. As we are speaking to you now, there are hundreds of thousands of people or more in the streets throughout the world as the mass strike against the financial elites centered in the city of London and Wall Street who have destroyed the global economy. These demonstrations continue to grow. This was the subject of the webcast done last Thursday by Lyndon LaRouche, which he titled Ireland and America, for reasons which are clear to you if you heard the webcast, or if not, will become clear to you by the end of this program today. These demonstrations, which stretch from the nations of the Middle East, such as Yemen and Bahrain, to the North African nations of Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya, to the city of Dresden in the state of Saxony in Germany, and into the states of the United States, such as Wisconsin, Ohio, and Texas, come as the global financial system is dead. It was killed by a process called globalization, which has destroyed once productive nations, such as ours, by turning the United States, as well as the nations of Western Europe, into post-industrial rubbish heaps, while creating conditions of deepening poverty, hunger, and hopelessness in what was once called the Third World or the developing sector. The globalized economy, with its nerve center located in offshore unregulated banking controlled by the City of London, is nothing but a global casino in which speculators place wild bets on anything and then expect the governments to bail them out with tens of trillions of dollars when their bets go bad, as they have since July 2007. And what do these criminals expect from governments? That they will slash budgets, condemning the citizens of their nations to a human scrap heap, with no money for education, health care, transportation, but unlimited funds in the form of bailouts for the speculators who bet wrong. Whether the enforcement is done by the International Monetary Fund for Egypt, or by the European Union for Greece, or by that stupid fascist governor of Wisconsin, the effect is the same: cuts in the living standards of the most vulnerable in the name of balanced budgets. As Lyndon LaRouche said Thursday during his webcast, these banks and financial institutions must be told that they have to eat their bad debts. No American teacher or fireman or policeman should have their wages cut to pay off these bad debts. No student should lose a teacher to be replaced by a computer in a classroom of 60 students to pay off these bad debts. And no sick or elderly or disabled person should lose their medical coverage to pay off these bad debts. This was the view expressed by Gerry Adams in his first speech to the Irish Parliament this week, when he said that the Irish people must not be made to pay for the criminal foolishness of the bankers. And this must become the view of those millions of demonstrators if they wish to survive. It's not just enough to protest, though that's a good, reasonable start. What LaRouche and his candidates' movement represents is a solution, starting with the Glass-Steagall bill, which would put the bankrupt banks in the bankruptcy reorganization and end the bailouts. We would also extend credit, federal credit, for major projects such as NWAPA, which would create between 4 and 7 million jobs in the United States, and provide federal funds for the states so there would be no need for cuts. And the real beauty of LaRouche's plan, which is based on the principles of credit which are embedded in our federal constitution and was known in the 19th century as the American system, is that this same program would work for every nation in the world. So, as LaRouche concluded his webcast, this mass strike gives us the opportunity to end the post-industrial, deregulated, genocidal, globalist nightmare and replace it with a system of productive relations between sovereign nation states based on the proven principles of the American system of physical economy. To discuss this mass strike and its dramatic implications today, I'm joined on the program by Carsten Werner, a leader of the Busso Party in Dresden in Germany, and a former candidate for mayor of Leipzig, and by Paul Gallagher of the Executive Intelligence Review, who has written extensively over the years on both the fraud of globalization and on the American economic system. And Paul has been watching the events in Ireland for us very closely. So Karsten and Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Arlie. Glad to be on.
Thank you. Welcome.
Karsten, you provided us this week with a stirring on-the-scene report from Dresden, where at least 17,000 teachers and others demonstrated against the austerity policies of the government of Saxony. Why don't we begin by having you tell us what you saw at that demonstration?
Yes. Well, this was a totally new quality. This was very obvious that we did not see a normal strike. And as you just mentioned, Lyndon LaRouche has been talking in his webcast in depth about this global mass strike. And I think so people can appreciate this a little bit more, I wanted to open this description of the demonstration up with a quote by Rosa Luxemburg, because this was also used by our six candidates for Congress in the United States. And I think it's a beautiful introduction to see what are we actually witnessing globally now. So this is it. "The mass strike, as the Russian Revolution shows it to us, is such a changeable phenomenon that it reflects all the phases of the political and economic struggle, all stages and factors of the revolution. It flows now like a broad billow over the whole kingdom, and now divides into a gigantic network of narrow streams. Now it bubbles forth from under the ground like a fresh spring, and now is completely lost on the earth. Political and economic strikes, mass strikes and partial strikes, demonstrative strikes and fighting strikes, general strikes of individual branches of industry and general strikes in individual towns, peaceful wage struggles and street massacres, barricade fighting, all these run through one another, run side by side, cross one another, flow in and over one another. It is a ceaselessly moving, changing sea of phenomena." So this was said by Rosa Luxemburg in 1906 in a short pamphlet titled The Mass Strike. And she was one of the few people who actually understood, next to maybe today only Lyndon LaRouche, what was really going on then and also today, that at a certain point people have had it. And what we witnessed this past Tuesday in Dresden was a strike that was called for by the teachers' union. So 17,000 teachers came out to Dresden directly in front of the finance ministry. And the number alone is quite a lot. And being there in the beginning, you would think it's a normal strike, you know, a lot of whistles and a lot of noise, and you have flags and pickets. But then when the finance minister of Saxony took to the podium, he just went on like the typical politician, basically lecturing these teachers and saying that, look, we've had this big crisis in 2009. It's nice that we can talk here about collective bargaining and that we come to a dialogue, but we don't have any maneuvering room because of this big crisis in 2009. And when he mentioned the crisis of 2009, the crowd went wild. We were in the middle of this thing distributing leaflets, and all of a sudden people started chanting as one organism, "Stop, stop." People just were freaked out that this, he could just blame the crisis on this the current developments. And when he wouldn't stop, they chanted again, "Stop, stop." And when he wouldn't stop, they just turned the backs on him.
That's very un-German behavior, isn't it, Karsten?
Sorry?
That's very un-German behavior, not very civil.
That's very true. Germany is normally supposed to be very, you know, you have Ordnung, you have your order, and you have your things.
Yeah.
So this is it's quite a break with normal manners. But this was just too much. So 17,000 teachers as one just turned the back and said, this is enough. And one person in the first row that we heard, we also had it on the video, screamed, "But you saved the banks, not the people."
Uh-huh.
And this is specific mentioning of the infamous state bank here in Saxony, the Sachsen-LB, which was one of the first banks to go under in 2007 when the so-called real estate crisis hit the U.S. Because this bank speculated in American real estate and subprime mortgages via an Irish SIV, these special investment vehicles, which normally should just totally be banned. And we're still paying millions almost monthly to that bank, while at the same time we're seeing brutal cuts in the police departments, brutal cuts in every other basic sector of society.
And Karsten,
so,
would you say that most of the teachers would agree with that statement when someone yelled out, "You saved the banks, what about us?" Is that a general sentiment?
Yes. We elicited this latest statement by Helga Zeplerush, the chairman of the BRISO here, saying Egypt is everywhere. I was telling people, look, we should cut the banks and not the people. And everybody said, yeah, of course, this is the only sector where no austerity is being done. So this is very obvious. I mean, and here's another very un-German thing that they did, which is that after he spoke, a union speaker picked up the microphone and said, look, you're talking to 17,000 academicians here. We don't need to be lectured on collective bargaining and the economic crisis. You are teachers, not because he basically treated them like fools. Yeah. And then the head of the Saxonian police union spoke, and the police is not normally famous for insulting state officials. But the head of the police union of Saxony was so enraged, his voice was like, he was almost yelling, but it was very honest and straightforward. He said, what you've just shown here, the finance minister of Saxony, is a very bad mixture of arrogance and ignorance, which in my mind adds up to stupidity. Now, that's an insult in Germany that I think it's almost illegal, because we have freedom of speech nominally, but you're not allowed to insult somebody, even if it's true.
Carsten, let me just ask before we pick up on this question of the spread to Ireland and elsewhere. We have seen the developments in Egypt and North Africa. Of course, in Ireland, the government was toppled, but everyone always looks at Germany as totally stable. And of course, what Helga Zeplerush said is that what she saw initially with what was happening in North Africa was the echoes of 1989. Now, I know from previous discussions with you that you were a young child who was at the demonstrations in Leipzig in 1989, which brought down the Honecker government, the government of the DDR. Are we seeing, in a sense, that echo becoming more conscious in people and spreading into such areas as fighting against the environmental regulations? Are we seeing a change now inside Germany?
I think so. People might not be as conscious of it, but when you raise it with people, when we talk to them at the book table or at the demonstration, they say, of course this is like 89, because we've just had it. Because remember, in 89, people were not starving to death or something. It was a minor incident that caused a mass uproar, which eventually brought down the whole thing, which was the question of freedom to travel into the West, because the wall was still standing. And that little thing became the big thing that eventually led to the downfall. So, and today, it's not that people are starving in Germany. Not yet. We will come there if we go on. But at some point, enough is enough. And what you just mentioned is very true, because what we're seeing in Germany is this, by decree, an introduction of these biofuels, that Germans are now forced to put a fuel into their tank, which is made up of 10% of ethanol. And people basically just boycotted it from day one. One, because it's inefficient. It's less economical. Second, there's a danger of destroying your motor, your gasoline tank, and everything else, even the roads. There was an accident where the roads... And thirdly, and this was also a surprise to me, that most people actually mentioned this point, they say, I don't want to put food into my tank. Mm-hmm. When I hear all the time on the news that we have hunger strikes in North Africa, this is just too much.
Well, and as Lynn said in his webcast on Thursday, one of the things you don't want to do is mess around with a German's car.
Yeah.
And having watched people park in Germany, I certainly understand that.
Yeah.
Well, and on this biofuel thing, I'll just point something out. I believe in many states of the United States, we now have 20% ethanol. Maybe Paul knows that the answer, but the Americans just seem to be taking it. But it does appear as though we're seeing a change. And I'd like to bring in Paul on this, because Paul, the sort of a harbinger for this has been the resistance in Ireland to the demands of the European Union for a dictatorship over Ireland. And with the vote, the Cowan government was tossed out, and it brought a much larger role for the Sinn Féin and Gerry Adams. Why don't you give our listeners a report on what happened in Ireland over the last, since the time of the election?
Yeah, if I could just you know, start by quickly making reference a little further back than that. There's no question when the demonstrations started breaking out in the United States in early February, February 10th, 11th, thereabouts, against these fascist austerity moves, the signs that many of the demonstrators had, teachers and others, some of them were referring from the beginning to Egypt, in particular, to the mass strike that had already erupted in a number of Arab countries and North African countries. And nonetheless, prior to that, had been the impetus of the Irish demonstrations and the Sinn Féin-led fight against this unbelievable bailout, most recent EU bailout of what are supposedly Irish banks, actually British banks, located in Ireland, and various special investment vehicles that the British banks and the other big international banks in Europe cooked up and located there in Dublin, but they're not Irish banks. But remember, 2 years before, the issue of sovereignty and the Lisbon Treaty in Europe,
right.
It was the Irish who not only voted it down. I mean, other countries would have voted it down also if and when they had the chance for a referendum. They didn't just vote it down. There were also mass demonstrations against the Lisbon Treaty, which threw that treaty off the rails for nearly a year until compulsion was brought to bear against the Irish government. And that really began the process of the complete eradication of this Fianna Fáil government in Ireland, which has now lost three-quarters of all of its seats in the parliament, have virtually disappeared from being the government. It's practically gone. But that's where it began. And already there, the leadership was taken by Sinn Féin, a party which, until a couple of years ago, could not be located, really, in the Republic of Ireland. It was known as a party that had a certain following in Ulster, which, of course, is not part of the Republic, but administered by the British. It's really part of Great Britain. And Sinn Féin was virtually off the charts. As Gerry Adams, its leader, has indicated, and this is something that we have reported before, in normal times, they had 1% or less. All of a sudden, they were taking a leading role because they're a party with principle. And I think the important thing to understand there is that they are the one party and the only party in Europe or the United States, or for that matter in Japan and so forth, the only party which can consistently be counted on to oppose bailouts and oppose usury as a organization, as a force. Really, the only other person you could think of in this crisis has been the president of Iceland, who was confronted with the same choice and submitted it to a referendum and basically let the banks go bankrupt, let the British banks go bankrupt. The only party which says that is the Sinn Féin in Ireland. And as a result, and what Gerry Adams says and said in his recent victory speech, after getting one of the highest votes in the entire Republic of Ireland in the recent election, for his and being elected to Parliament, he said, "The Irish people don't owe this debt. They will not pay this debt. Burn the bondholders of the banks instead. Separate the credit of Ireland from the monetary debts of these essentially British banks. Burn the bondholders of those banks. No compromise on this." And it is that approach which has catapulted Sinn Féin from a fraction of a percent to 12 to 15% of the national vote and 15 members in the Dáil, the Irish Parliament, to where they are now in the midst of a mass strike process which is going to overthrow this bailout.
Now, on the bailout question, I'll throw this back to Carsten. And by the way, you're listening to The LaRouche Show. Today is March 12, 2011. We're in the midst of a mass strike process, and if people have not yet seen it, the webcast Ireland and America was done by Lyndon LaRouche just 2 days ago, and it's on the website. It's archived, and you can look at it. And Lynn takes up the theme that Karsten opened the program with of the mass strike and talked in depth about this question of how people are brought into a convergence with something that they don't quite understand, and yet they have to be there. As Karsten said, enough is enough. They're ready to fight, and the question is the will there be clarity as to the cause of the problem and then also the solutions? Now, Karsten, there was a European Union leadership meeting yesterday, and this has been the culmination of a long process of the EU bureaucrats, Van Rompuy, Olli Rehn, Jean-Claude Trichet from the European Central Bank and others, trying to force the German government to accept the idea of an expanded bailout. And according to the initial reports we have, Chancellor Merkel did go along with that at this event. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and what do you think the reaction will be in Germany as people hear that they're now going to be liable for maybe as much as another 200 billion euros in bailout funds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the information we got now is that, I mean, people should know that the government of Merkel in Germany has always been resisting this idea of increasing the bailout fund because, of course, the major chunk of it is going to be paid by Germany, which is the case in any case in all kinds of bailout processes the last years. But the proposal was always to double it. Now, what has happened, according to our information, is that the rescue fund was increased from 250 billion euros to a full 440 billion euros. So Merkel, she said it's a success because it will only be made available, the money will only be made available to countries that need it if they comply with the very strict conditionalities, which, of course, it's crap. So you see, there must be immense pressure by the European Union, by the IMF, on these countries, especially on Germany, to pay this. And what really is telling is that we also got to know that the head of Goldman Sachs in Europe is one Peter Sutherland. He's advising the Irish government on the bailout, on the austerity measures. And he gave an interview with the German magazine Spiegel Online on March 11th. And he said, now we have some better... Ireland is going along as we are telling them to do. They're implementing the austerity, so they can get better conditions for the credit they're taking. But a haircut for the banks would be destructive. And you know that senior bondholders are sitting in Germany, and they will not be touched. This we have made clear. And this Ireland has to accept. That's a quote. So it's totally obvious who this is about.
That goes against what Jerry Adams said. I believe, Paul, didn't he say that they're not going to pay?
Yeah, he and a significant opposition in the parliament headed by him, which includes Sinn Féin and independent and socialist deputies, in total about 50 deputies, they are demanding a referendum, which will undoubtedly overturn this bailout. They also want a referendum which may begin the process of bringing Ulster into Ireland and making a unified Ireland. But this will be defeated by the Irish mass strike. There's no way that this can be. I mean, you have to understand this is a $127 billion loan, quote-unquote, at an interest rate which is north of 7%, and it's imposed on a country of 4.5 million people. That's the size of the state of Virginia. So one could imagine a middle-sized state in the United States, even smaller than middle-sized, suddenly taking on an additional $125 billion of debt at an interest rate of over 7. The interest alone on this bailout, which is a bailout for the banks, not for Ireland, for these British banks, Allied Irish, Anglo-Irish, Royal Bank of Scotland, and so forth in their Irish operation, this interest on this loan alone for the bailout is half the budget of the Republic of Ireland.
And none of that does anything for the people of Ireland.
Oh, my God. just the opposite. You know, the country is in, its economy is in free fall. The services are falling apart. They recently had the complete collapse of water fresh water availability for a significant period of weeks in north part of the north of the Republic.
Well, let me make this then very clear for our listeners in the United States who sometimes don't quite get let's just say nuances, because these are not really nuances. But you're having a $125 billion debt imposed on the people of Ireland. A large portion of the money is going to be borrowed from the people of Germany, and it's going to go to the British banks, and it's not clear that the Irish will ever pay that back.
And hardly a significant part of the rest of it has already been taken, borrowed, quote-unquote, taken from the national pension funds of the people of Ireland.
Right.
So,
now, Carsten, is this something I asked Mrs. LaRouche a couple of times about this. Do the people in Germany realize that they have become the lender of last resort to these bankrupt banks?
Yes, they hate it. I mean, they're usually being taught and brought up in a way where we're not supposed to say that we've had it and Germany cannot pay all this, because then the Nazi club is being taken out, which of course is ridiculous if you're talking about bailing out banks at the expense of taxpayers. But there was one thing. Mrs. LaRouche has actually written a new article, and in there she has one thing that the head of the highest German court in Germany, of the Verfassungsgericht, Andreas Voskuhle, has given a very interesting statement. And people should know that the highest court in Germany is one of the few institutions in Germany that have defended sovereignty in Germany, which is that not all the power is being given to the European Union, which is the process we've been witnessing over the last 20 years with the so-called Maastricht Treaty and then the debt break, not a debt ceiling, and all these other things. And recently there was actually a suit, a legal complaint by five economic professors against this rescue package, which we're talking about here. And decision is still out, still coming, forthcoming. But the head of the German highest court now said that he just wanted to make clear that we're not hostile to Europe. We just wanted to avoid that the European Union takes more and more competencies, which means sovereign departments, mm-hmm. like the budget and other things, into the European Union without the German people having any say in this. So, and Mrs. Sepp-LaRouche's analysis on this is, okay, if he's saying this, then there's only two options left. One is that they will decide that the rescue package is actually illegal because Germans don't have any say in this, and this is a major change. There should be a referendum, a national one. And then if they rule for this, then the euro would break up. We could go back to the D-mark, a sovereign currency. Or they say that it goes into conformity with our constitution, but that we need to have a national referendum. And then you can imagine what the German people will vote for.
Well, Carsten, and you brought up an important point, because the threat that's always held over the heads of Germans, going back to the 1989, 90, 91 period of reunification, is that any claim to German sovereignty is a return to the Nazi Third Reich. And even former Chancellor Helmut Schmidt recently made reference to this by saying, look, the Germans owe Europe because of what they did in the last century. So it does appear as though this is a club that's being wielded, but at the same time, it's besides being patently absurd, the German people, I think, are getting to the point where they're going to say, we are going to take care of our own nation. So when we go out and organize and we talk about returning to the D-mark and throwing off the euro, do we get a lot of support for that?
You're basically preaching to the choir, mm-hmm. because people have just witnessed one order from another. Now you already mentioned the biofuels. That comes from the European Union, that they have to put gas in their tank, which destroys the tank, and it's food. We have stupid things like how much curve the banana could be. All the financial regulations, or shall we say deregulations, have mostly come from the European Union, and so on and so forth. So, and people, there's just no connection between, you can imagine, there's no connection between the German people on the work on the street, you know, trying to get through life, and then this huge bureaucratic apparatus in Brussels with thousands of bureaucrats who pump out one directive after another, all to the damage of the people, not only of Germany, but of all of them. So it's an absurd argument to say that, you know, the Germans are trying to get back to a Reich. I mean, what is happening is the European Union is building a Reich without the consent of the people.
Right. Now, Paul, I want to just shift a little bit to the broader economic picture, because we have a Federal Open Market Committee meeting coming up this week. Bernanke has made it clear that he says there's no hyperinflation. This has nothing to do with the trillions the Fed has been pumping into the banks. And there is resistance from some quarters in the Federal Reserve, but it looks as though that doesn't matter to Bernanke. He's going to go ahead with this. Do you have any sense of what's going to happen with this fight in the Federal Reserve? And also, if from your work in the Congress, is anyone in the Congress paying attention, or are they the brain-dead boomers that Lyndon LaRouche has been insisting they are?
Well, you know, there again, you have a dynamic which is going to have to come from outside the Congress, from the people who are going out and rising up and rebelling against this. Because, yeah, there are people in the Congress who, when Bernanke testifies at various committees, they rake him over the coals about causing inflation with the so-called quantitative easing too. And next week at the Fed meeting, he wants to start quantitative easing 3 with maybe another $500 billion, maybe another trillion of printed money. I don't know for sure that he'll succeed in getting that through the board of the presidents of the Fed banks. But when the congressmen go after him on this, it lasts a minute, and then they immediately lapse into debt. And their use of Bernanke is trying to get him to agree with them that cutting the budget and cutting the deficit is the number one problem of the country, and it's all a complete lie. And he goes along totally and says, yes, it is the number one problem. Cut Social Security, cut Medicare. And so he's in an alliance with them. He's a regular meeting participant of the what we call the Cat Food Commission and the groups in the Congress who want to implement the drastic cuts in entitlements of the Cat Food Commission. He's right in among them. So there's a lot of resistance, and I don't know. We have sources who say he will get this through next week. I'm not so sure. It's useful at the same time. Look at the IMF. Just came out with a staff report, which was pretty alarming. It was described as sending up flares about the international bank banks. It said, you know, nothing's changed. They haven't written off any of the toxic assets.
Well, Paul, doesn't this, because you were talking about this earlier, the momentum toward Glass-Steagall, this has been a point that Lyndon LaRouche has been pounding now. The 6 LaRouche candidates are putting Glass-Steagall up front in everything they're doing, and we're beginning to see in these demonstrations. For example, I have a report from earlier today that there might have been 100,000 people marching in Madison, Wisconsin today, which kind of makes me feel good since I'm a graduate of the University of Wisconsin. I may have been there the last time there were that many students demonstrating. In Austin, Texas today, 10,000 to 12,000 teachers are demonstrating. And when they see our signs on Glass-Steagall now, people are coming up and they're saying, I'm for Glass-Steagall. We have some developments in the Congress. We have an email to the show here today from Brian, who's with the Berkeley Federation of Teachers. He's a teacher, saying, shouldn't we be pushing harder for Glass-Steagall and put Obama on the spot with this? That Obama's on the wrong side on this one. Isn't this a way we can give people the courage to throw him out? This could be the next couple of weeks, the period where this thing blows up, couldn't it?
Yes. We are pushing very hard. I take the point of the emailer and the listener. We are definitely pushing very hard, but that's not what we do on the Hill with talking to members of Congress. That's definitely not going to get it done. It's they're in a situation where people are rising up in the country. There's a mass strike going on. It's interesting because in some places you have competing large demonstrations of unionists and other working and middle class people over against smaller demonstrations of the Tea Party. Don't forget the Tea Party. And both of those demonstrations are part of the mass strike. because it was really those people who came out first 2 years ago against Obama's fascist healthcare, Obamacare. Yeah. Then over the course of the last year and a half, they've gotten completely disoriented, most of them, at least in part, by the idea that you've got to cut the government down. Because why? Because we failed in stopping the bailouts, which is what really got them moving in the first place. The frustration of being unable to stop the bailouts and being unable to get something like Glass-Steagall drove them into this other position. But now they're being overwhelmed by much larger forces of Americans who are coming out and throwing the gauntlet down against Wall Street again, throwing the enemy image back on the Wall Street investment banks where it belongs. And so those people who call themselves Tea Party are being affected by this as well. And even in Congress, I went to one hearing last week where they had as witnesses teachers from Wisconsin, Ohio, a parole officer from Ohio, from Indiana. They had a leader of a policeman's union and various economists. And it was all about this mass strike process. And these people were extraordinarily interested in Glass-Steagall, the witnesses, one of the congressmen and the witnesses. That's the we've got to get it introduced by the leveraging of those kind of processes, you know, where the pressure of these really mass demonstrations takes force on members of Congress who understand that if they aren't going to, Democrats in particular, if they aren't going to give away everything that they thought they would fight for, Social Security, Medicare, national security, and so forth, if they aren't going to abandon it all, they have to direct the fury of the American people back against Wall Street and put a solution in front of that in order to do it.
And I would say not just against Wall Street, but in particular against that fascist puppet of the City of London, Barack Obama. As LaRouche has emphasized, with Obama in there, he's going to do everything he can to screw up Glass-Steagall. Now, that brings me back to the point that we started with Karsten on this question of the mass strike. And I'd like to bring Karsten back in on this because he and I have had discussions of these questions of the higher quality of the human soul, which is not just amenable, but actually is, by its very nature, drawn toward these higher principles that you don't always see that are outside of the sense perception. And we do have an email from Gerald Pechnik who asks about the role of the unseen in the form of classical culture. And he mentions the German classical cultural history in Wisconsin, both with the former mayor of Milwaukee, the New Glarus, which is a town I used to go through when I was up in Madison. Every year they perform Schiller's play Wilhelm Tell there, which is against the tyrants. And, of course, Saxony, where you had the birth of the 1989 revolution, is the center of some of the greatest scientific and cultural figures, including Bach, who was in Leipzig for years, Leibniz, who was born there, the Mendelssohn-Schumann collaboration, and so on. So, Karsten, I know you've given this a lot of thought, the special nature of Saxony, and I know, of course, you are close friends with my good friend Marcus, who's probably the leading Saxon chauvinist on the planet. But I think there's probably some good reason for that. So I know you've been talking about this question of the unseen character of the mass strike process. Mm-hmm. Give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I would like to bring in a surprising element for Americans, because if you look at 1989, the interesting thing is that, it's particular in Saxony, there was one point, as we already said, where too much was too much. The decision was already made. The politicians could do what they want. You look at Honecker's remarks weeks before the Soviet Union came down, Honecker being the head of the GDR, and he said things like, the wall's going to stand another 50 or 100 years. He said, socialism in its course is going to be stopped neither by donkey nor horse, and stuff like this. So they were just totally out of reality, but they were just being swept away. And I think one crucial element that gave the Saxonian people and the people of East Germany the power of the soul, the inner strength to do this, was the classical culture. The irony of the thing is that one of the things the Soviet Union didn't dare do was to suppress the classical culture, the German classical culture, as much as was done in the West, where there was a huge operation after the Second World War to attack all classical culture, especially Beethoven and Schiller, as fascist because they were too authoritative. That wasn't done in the East, so you still have a very strong tradition among the older people now with choruses, church music, Bach especially. And in 89, when people were out demonstrating against the GDR, they were singing. They were singing folk tunes like The Thoughts Are Free. And what I would like to bring up is that this principle of 89 was not just something that came out of Germany. It's not a German thing as such, even though it came in a very individual or in this particular national form. But you actually find this principle of the mass strike, in my mind, in the American Declaration of Independence, where it's being said if a government for too long tramples on these basic principles, on the pursuit of happiness, the right to life and liberty, people will take it for a while because they don't want chaos, they don't want disorder, they'd rather have it for a few years unorderly or bad government. But at a certain point, when enough is enough, they will take down that government and take back their rights. And so you have it right there in the Declaration of Independence. So, and as you said, a lot of the demonstrators in Wisconsin are of German origin, so maybe there's a certain connection. But this is, I think it's an innate principle in humanity, which people are not so conscious of, but at certain points at these great crises takes control of them.
Well, I know the Busso, very much like the LaRouche youth movement, brings music and classical culture into our organizing. And I know that you were there in the commemoration, the 20-year commemoration of 1989, where, again, I believe, weren't there over 100,000 people who showed up in Leipzig, and our chorus was out there singing. This is actually what Lynn has been emphasizing with the development of the youth movement, and also the particular role that teachers can play, is this idea that we have to develop the creative potential of the youth. And from what I saw the last time I was with you in Saxony, I saw a potential beginning to emerge with youth, particularly at a science school like the university in Jena. But I assume that we're engaging in a recruitment process as part of our campaigns there. And I'd like to just ask you if you know more about what's happening with these campaigns in Stuttgart and Berlin, because one of the things I heard earlier today, I think from you, is that with the earthquake in Japan and the reports of the problems of the nuclear plants, the Greens, in the form of this absolutely ugly beast, Kunast, they're coming forward now saying, shut down nuclear. They're trying to reimpose this scientific Gestapo to stop the thinking and stop to change the subject. So right. How can we intervene into that with the work we're doing with the Busso?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is really outrageous. We had a talk, you and me, about this earlier today, that here you have this really bad catastrophe, and, you know, my pity with all of these victims over there. But it's not the point that you have over 1,000 victims already reported. So what does it help them if you shut down nuclear power plants in Germany and make a huge debate out of this? It's so obvious that this is just basic political campaigning. And there was a huge demonstration in Stuttgart today where elections are going to take place against nuclear power. Was planned a long time beforehand. So this is basically, I mean, the Greens obviously use this specific insanity that you still have in the German population, but which is turning. I mean, if even the mass tabloid Bild-Zeitung, which is, you know, the measure of stupidity in Germany, even they write a very short commentary ripping apart each single one of these environmental measures you've had, which is that you clean your yogurts, you know, when you buy yogurt, you clean out the thing afterwards, yeah. Rinse it before you throw it away. You have these stupid environmental zones where you're not allowed to drive in with your car if it doesn't fulfill certain standards. You have the biofuel now, and so on and so forth. They rip it all apart in this one commentary. And then they say at the end, but the German still goes along all in the name of the environment. Huh. And there's a big turn, and this does not come from Bild-Zeitung. This comes from the people themselves who slowly start to realize that they have been fooled on this environmental question. And it's especially clear on this E10, on the biofuel question now. Nobody on the street defends this. Everybody sees it's crazy. And there's a very hypocritical campaign now by the Greens to try to tell, oh, we were always against this biofuels, which is simply a lie. Just go back 10 years and you'll see all the reports in the European Parliament by the Greens. So this is also what we're using in the organizing, not as the main issue, but just to show how bankrupt the whole political class is, not just the Greens. And there's a big response and a big thirst for our ideas now, because what we discussed earlier, if people see the connection between, you know, the banks get bailed out and now a doubling of this rescue fund, European Rescue Fund, at the same time even more brutal cuts into the basic services everybody needs every day, it just doesn't make sense to people.
Well, it seems to me, Carsten, the other thing is that we can use this hypocrisy of the Greens to make the point, okay, you want to improve conditions of life for people, then let's make the mission of Germany the program of Helga Zeppler-Rusch and the Busso candidates, which is European and Eurasian infrastructure, the development of the Transaqua platform, the development of nuclear power so that we can provide for food and basic needs for people around the world. It seems to me that's the direction the mass strike can take us.
Yep.
Well, also, you know, in Ireland, where there is this ongoing mass strike and really a fight not only for sovereignty but for the most basic conditions of existential conditions of life in the country. I mean, the population is falling. People are having to leave. The Greens, who totally supported this outrageous bailout, it wasn't only the Fianna Fáil, the government party, that was practically eliminated in the election, but the Greens were completely eliminated, you know, because they were on the wrong side of the destruction of life in Ireland, you know, provoking potentially another forced emigration of hundreds of thousands or a million people out of Ireland. They were on the wrong side of that. And so they are finished.
Hey, Paul, one of the things that I opened the show with is I said that by the end of the program, people would know why LaRouche talked about Ireland and America. And I don't want to forget that, because I know that's one of the things that we had discussed. What is this question that binds the Irish and the Americans in terms of beyond just the anti-British side of it, which is a pretty useful thing?
It certainly is.
But how does that manifest itself in terms of the history of these two nations?
Beyond that point, which in itself is important because there's an awareness among the leadership in Ireland of the direction, the British imperial direction from which this comes, which in America has a lot of it has been lost. But, you know, the mass strike really was first described by the great English poet Percy Shelley, and he first described it while visiting and organizing in Ireland in his pamphlets, which were called the First and Second Defenses of the Irish People, which were really mass political pamphlets that he wrote in order to hand out himself as a teenager while he was there. And in those pamphlets, he gives the first basic description of a crisis-driven change in the opinion of masses of people, very sudden change, in which they become preoccupied not with their own particulars, but rather with the general, as he said, with the general welfare. Those pamphlets are also places where he directly references the American Declaration of Independence, the excellence of the American Constitution vis-a-vis others, and the Lafayette's Declaration of the Rights of Man. So this was a very fundamental thing that he saw, even as a very young man. It had This was in 1810. It had really started in a serious way 20 years before that, when the Irish first gained a constitution against the British, and they did it with the support of Americans and really with Irish revolutionaries going back and forth between the United States and Ireland, where there was already a significant Scotch and Irish population, which had taken leading parts in the American Revolution. So that there was a transatlantic unity in terms of fighting for sovereignty and republican rights against the British already in the 1780s. And I can't go through it all now, it really continued very strongly. There was a concerted attempt to smash this by leading British conservative Tories in the 1860s and 1870s, led by Sir Winston Churchill's grandfather, Lord Randolph Churchill. And that resulted in the breaking off of Ulster and the creation of a real British battering ram in the six counties in the north of Ireland called Ulster. But despite of that, you had continuously the complete interpenetration is not even the word. They were almost the same organizations which were active in the American system, economic policies on this side, with Henry Carey, Lincoln's economist, and his circles in Pennsylvania, including Irish leaders who were directly members of the same organizations which were fighting for home rule, for land for Irish peasants, for independence for Ireland at a later point. And when this succeeded in 1920, 21, 22, finally, it did so as a result of the formation of the Sinn Féin Party by a group of leaders who were explicitly devoted to what they called the American system of economics.
You know, Paul, when you are going through this history, it brings also this idea of a historic continuum, the way Lyndon LaRouche discusses it, which also affects the question of Germany, because it was in that period around late 70s, early 1880s, that Chancellor Bismarck adopted the ideas of the American system, and a key person in that was the writings of Henry Carey, the Irish-American. And then, of course, the British reached the conclusion by 1890 that they had to destroy Germany. And in a sense, the 1890 to 2011 period has been a period in which the British have focused on destroying the American system in the United States with puppets such as George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and they're trying to continue that process from 1890 to 2011 by breaking up Germany. And Carsten, I'd just like to ask you, I know that a large part of what we're trying to do is to put forward this idea of the positive culture that goes back to Leibniz and Kepler, that's the tradition of Bach and Beethoven, and as well the economic policies of the American system as brought back by Bismarck. So this is part of this whole mass strike process, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it was a good idea that somebody named the capital of North Dakota Bismarck. It was because this was a pretty big fight. I mean, you have a problem in German history and up until today of really understanding this British question, which, as Paul just described, in Ireland and in America is much more obvious because of the simple founding history of the countries. But Bismarck was one of the few persons who really understood what was going on. And he described that, you know, free trade is simply a myth. But people have to know that before he got to know Henry C. Carey via certain circles, he was also a totally free trader or traitor or whatever you want to call it. So he learned by getting to know Henry C. Carey that free trade means nothing else than, and this is almost a quote, that it's the fist right, the British fist right. Because if you have no regulation, no government control, the one who is the strongest always wins. And that, of course, at that time was always the British. So he understood this question and imposed regulations, tariffs. He unified the German rail for the first time out of all these fiefs and kingdoms into one national system. And that is the basis for this big productive economy we have today. One of the other things I recently found out, he was also a bass singer in the famous Berlin Singakademie, which goes all the way back to the beginning of the 1800s and has premiered a lot of vocal works by all the leading composers. And he... He made comments on Schiller, so he was also really a product of this type of German culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then his policies became a casus belli, a cause of war for the British, which led to the period from the 1890 to 1914 of organizing virtually everything in Europe around a geopolitical doctrine to build an alliance to go to war to destroy Germany and pit Germany against Russia. Mm-hmm. And that was the whole 20th century, the great wars of the 20th century. We're down to about a little more than 5 minutes. I just want to come back to this mass strike situation in the United States now. Paul, with these large demonstrations today, it's clear that the rigged vote that Governor Walker of Wisconsin pulled off this last week isn't going to stop things. How closely are people in the Congress paying attention to the students walking out of schools in Idaho and Florida and Arizona? I mean, is this registering in the political class?
It is with those members of Congress who come from those places. And as it spreads, that's why you saw those, I guess it was 15 Democrats holding that hearing last Wednesday that I was organizing at. Almost all of them, a few were from California, almost all of the rest were from the upper Midwest states, which are being convulsed by these mass demonstrations through blizzards and everything else. And so they know that they have to react. For the most part, this situation there is very bad because of the stupidity, the kind of baby boomer stupidity of most of the members of Congress, and the utter lack of leadership is a mild word. The devastating impact on them of the corruption of Obama, which has just really thrown the Republicans into a manic idea that they can do whatever they like, the most ideological of them, and the Democrats into complete funk and dog-like obedience to this cut the budget, cut the deficit stuff. So, they're just in the very beginnings of the process of being lifted out of that by this demand from hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people manifest, and from many others who you don't see out in the street, this demand to go after Wall Street and stop all this fascist austerity.
We were just given a good tool for that with Lyndon LaRouche's statement on bad banks. It's now up on our website, LaRouchePact.com. This is something that should be distributed, and I think that people who are going to these demonstrations have to insist that there should be no budget cuts, no compromises with budget cutters, because they're going to kill people. Secondly, the way you deal with the budget problem is you get Glass-Steagall, and you cancel the bailouts, and you get the money back, and let the bankers deal with their bad debts. And I know this is a policy that will work not just for the United States, but this is what Gerry Adams is talking about in Ireland. And, Paul, I want to make one correction. You said that Sinn Féin is the only party, along with the president of Iceland, pushing this in Europe. But the Buso, this is our strategy. And Carsten,
yes, of course.
Just in the last minute and a half here, we do have a candidate in Stuttgart. And how is that campaign going?
Well, there's very, very optimistic reports from on the ground there because, as I said before, people should know, this is part of the place in Germany where you have a lot of productive companies still, the famous German Mittelstand, the entrepreneurial basis, and they are reacting very strongly to our saying, okay, cancel the toxic debt and go for a global reconstruction program. This is what makes Germans proud again. If you tell them Germany can play a major role with its engineering capacities, which is world famous, in rebuilding the world, as we have done in the past in Africa, in Asia. So this is getting very good responses.
So we have to cancel biofuels and cancel the Greens.
Yeah, save the rainforest and send the Greens there.
And find a wildlife preserve for Kunast so she doesn't harass Berliners.
Yeah.
And remember, as LaRouche has said, unbalanced minds cannot balance budgets.
Well,
this
has been a very useful discussion on the global breadth and depth of the mass strike process. Carsten Werner from Dresden, thanks for joining us. Pleasure talking to you. And Paul, good to have you on. Go to the website, LaRouchePack.com, and listen to Lyndon LaRouche on Ireland and America. It's the best way you can get oriented toward going out and providing the leadership in this mass strike which is needed. There's an unseen quality to the motion, but we have to give it the ideas that will radiate very quickly into the leadership of people in motion now. So thanks for joining us today on The LaRouche Show, and we'll be back next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern.